Welcome to 11. On the next two, my goal is to deal with seemingly gratuitous moral evils, to give the theist some inroads, some development, some ideas by which to answer and deal with the skeptic or atheist who claims that seemingly gratuitous evils are keeping them from believing in an all-good, all-powerful, all-knowing God. Then, on 13 and 14, I'd like to deal with philosophical and theological proposals for dealing with seemingly natural, seemingly gratuitous natural evils, and also to conclude our course on 14. And so we turn to seemingly gratuitous moral evils. What does that long phrase mean, seemingly gratuitous moral evils? A gratuitous evil is one for which there is no good justifying purpose, for which God, if he existed or exists, would have for allowing that evil. A gratuitous evil is one really that shouldn't have existed. It really does harm the person permanently, and there is never a redeeming good for that evil. There's not even the possibility of a redeeming good for that evil in the future. Not possibility as in logical possibility, but possibility as in realistic potential. That God's allowing that evil really did have a realistic potential for a good for that person to come about and justify God's allowance of that evil at that time. Now, that's a gratuitous evil. A seemingly gratuitous evil is an evil that seems to us that God would have no justifying reason to permit. So, a seemingly gratuitous moral evil is a moral evil that is seemingly gratuitous. Moral evil, again, is just an evil brought about by the misuse of a free-willed being, a demon or, more in view to us, of course, human misuse of freedom. So, as theists, how do we respond to seemingly gratuitous moral evils? In this course so far, we have given different reasons for why God allows or might allow evils to occur. I think it's important to remember Roe's four questions. Roe's four questions, given a few tapes back, was sort of this mounting, suspenseful question-making, such that you ask first, why does God allow any evil at all? And then you ask a little harder question, why does God allow the kinds or types of evils that he does? And then you move on to the third level of theodicy. Why does God allow the amount of evil? Understanding with amount, intensity, distribution, magnitude, and so forth, of evil in the world. And finally, fourthly, the hardest question that the atheist poses to the theist, why does God allow these particular, seemingly gratuitous evils to occur? And so it's good to just make some comments about these four questions. One thing is to notice Roe's second question, why does God allow the kinds or types of evils that he does in the world? It's very important to notice that tokens, particular instances of things, tokens fall under types. Okay, so if I clap my hand, that is a token. It's one instance of the clapping of a hand. But that token falls under a type, namely all claps, or the concept of clapping one's hand. Now, Roe thinks that Hicks' theodicy, Roe in a later article makes this claim, Roe thinks in a 1988 article entitled Evil and Theodicy in the journal Philosophical Topics, Roe thinks that Hicks' theodicy does help to answer the first two questions that Roe poses. Namely, Roe thinks that Hicks the Odyssey does a good job of answering why God allows any evil at all, because it's necessary for soul-making, soul development. And secondly, Roe thinks that Hicks the Odyssey answers the second question Roe poses well, namely, why does God allow the kinds or types of evils that he does? But look, if God allows certain kinds and types of evils, and Roe agrees that Hicks' theodicy is successful in answering why God is justified in allowing those kinds and types of evil, then doesn't it follow that if certain types are justified by God's allowing them, then certainly certain tokens that fall underneath those types are allowed? So say that God allows strangulation in this world. He allows human beings upon occasions to strangle another human being. Say that that's allowed for whatever reason. Then certainly a certain token of a strangulation falls under that type. Okay, so what happens in effect is that tokens fall under types. We need to remember that. If Roe thinks that Hick has explained why God allows certain types of evils, for example, strangulation, say, then is Roe really justified in referring to a token, that is, a particular instance of a strangulation, and saying that God should not have allowed that? So it seems to me that Roe needs to reconnoiter, review his questions, and see how his question 2, why does God allow certain types or kinds of evils to occur in the world, how question 2 there is related to question 4, upon which he bases his evidential argument from evil. Why does God allow these particular instances, such as Sue and the fawn, these particular instances of suffering to occur in the world? So tokens and types are related in that way. I think it's also important to make some distinctions along these lines. Sometimes God's reasons for allowing an evil to occur are person-specific, or what we might call person-referring in nature. One could also include set-specific goods here, or set-specific reasons, where the set referred to is some finite, definite number of people in view. For example, think of Thornton Wilder's short book, The Bridge Over San Luis Rey. At the beginning of a book, 5 people are walking across somewhere in South America. They're walking across a rope, a bridge between 2 cliffs, supported by this bridge, and the bridge is made of ropes. 5 people are on it. The bridge gives out and fails, and the 5 people fall to their deaths. Now, throughout the whole book, the question is, was there some reason, was there some interconnectedness between these 5 people? And as Wilder tells the story, there was, in fact, a sort of reason for these 5 people to die and to die together at that time. That would be a person-specific or set-specific good. That is, the good or the reason why God would allow the bridge to fail and those people to die at that time. But there's also global goods. Okay? For example, so the distinction here is between person-specific goods and global goods. There may be reasons for God to allow types or tokens of evils, but especially types of evils, and those reasons may be global in nature. For example, God creates human people to be free creatures, but sometimes they use their freedom to do what is wrong. Yet, God allows them to go wrong, because he desires humans to be free, or the results of human beings, or he desires the results of humans being free, namely, to turn to him freely, for example. And so you notice the distinction between person-specific goods and global goods that he has in mind. Or person-specific allowings, he may allow certain evils in my life for the good of me, or the good of me and some other people, for example, my family. And yet, in general, there are global goods or global allowings. God allows the rain to fall according to, as far as we can tell, certain natural patterns. That's a global sort of allowing that God intends. There may not be when a town floods, for example, or when a certain rain causes damage to a certain farmer. There may not be a specific volition behind the deity at that point to cause that harm. But rather, in effect, in our theodicy, we believe that God allows things to occur, evils in the world, so that we might overcome them, surmount them, be sympathetic to those who suffer, be compassionate and be moved and show Christian love, even as Christ commands us, to those people, that we might grow in maturity, come to rely upon God, and turn away from ourselves. Those are global allowings that are just as effective as specific, can be just as effective as God's allowing certain evils directly from his divine intention into my life. So the globals, the global allowings or global goods that God allows are very important, and so are the person specifics. Think for a second of a person-specific good. For example, God might allow me, or Jesus, or Job, or you, or anyone else, to suffer something, X, let's say, on some occasion, S, because suffering X on S was the best way, or a most probable way, to bring about a greater good, G, for the sufferer. Okay, that would be the way God would work with a person-specific good. Okay, so God's allowing that suffering may be in line with global reasons he ordained to be the case in the world, or it may fall beyond ordinary global reasons for allowing evils, allowing suffering. For example, consider Paul's shipwreck on Malta, as recorded in Acts 28. This was an evil that was brought about, for all we know, through natural means. However, Gomorrah's destruction was not brought about by natural means. Neither were, most likely, the plagues of Egypt or the Passover slaying in Egypt. And so all of this to introduce the following proposal. I claim that, I submit that, the following. To defend Christian theism in light of seemingly gratuitous moral evils, the theist will be best instructed to treat evils on a one-by-one basis, attempting, first, 1, to get as much value out of the global goods as is allowed, at least to stress that God has created an overall good world, Genesis 1:27. 131, and that he intends that we enjoy this life, even though we have brought ourselves to much evil and suffering due to our own activities and free actions. Then, the theist is best to move, secondly, to get as much value out of the person-specific goods as they are related to the other common goods, common global goods. So it is important that we as Christians call evil, evil, and suffering bad, intrinsically. but we can call upon the components of our theory to defend our beliefs and present Christian theism as not disconfirmed by evil, even horrendous evils. We believe that God's goods will defeat evil in a way that the evils were necessary for the actuality or necessary for the probable actuality of certain greater goods, offsetting goods, defeating goods. Ultimately, with William Alston, we may be completely justified in thinking that, 3, God can take up whatever slack he needs to justify a good, to justify an evil by supplying goods to a situation, goods that are entirely beyond our ken, goods that entirely outstrip our cognitive abilities to understand. But lastly, 4, there may be certain person-specific or set-specific goods that are not global goods, but which play a crucial role in offsetting and defeating horrendous evils like Sue's suffering. Notice now what we said about the value of human life. Sometime back, we mentioned that we would return to this point, and the point has arrived, and it's this, that it seems to me that there is no best possible world, but God is all good. And so, through various lines of reasoning, it seems to me altogether fair and good that God has to make sure that for each human life that a human lives in this world, that that life, through no fault of God, maybe through the fault of their own, but through no fault of God, that their life, each human's life, has to be better to have been lived than not to have been lived. Okay, that's God's sort of minimal duty to all human life. Human beings' lives have to be better to have been lived than not to have been lived. Of course, I'm reading Judas's, what the Gospels say about Judas, what Jesus says, in fact, about Judas' life. I'm reading that hyperbolically and not literally. When Jesus says, it would have been better had Judas never been born. We do not read that literally, but only, in fact, hyperbolically. In other words, Jesus is saying, in view of this terrible thing he's going to do, it would have been better had he not been born. But he's not addressing there specifically the value, qua human being, of Judas's life. Because, after all, Judas made the decisions that led to, and made them freely, that led to the demise of his life in the first place. God's not responsible for those decisions. Judas is, and therefore the value of his life must be taken into account underneath that reality that God was not responsible for the downfall of Judas. So we said, 4 above, that there may be person-specific or set-specific goods that are not global goods, but which play a crucial role in offsetting and defeating horrendous evils like Sue's suffering. Rose E2 case. What might some of those goods look like? We come then to some theological suggestions drawn from Christian theism. A reference is made here then to soteriology. Here are some claims. It was through Christ's suffering that a greater good was achieved, not for Christ per se, but directly for humankind. Could it be that through Sue's suffering, considering the intensity of her suffering in direct proportion to the suffering of Christ, through her suffering there is the achievement of a greater good? Now, once again, in order to appreciate Rowe's stance when it comes to ethical theory, we must remember that Rowe is committed to G.E. Moore's ethical discussion and theory as defined in Moore's Ethical Works, and principally in the Principia Ethica, Principles of Ethics, 1903. And so, let's look to Moore's theory to see if there isn't something there that will help us to appreciate Sue's suffering for what it is. And so it's kind of what we might call a Roe-specific proposal. We're going to look at G.E. Moore's discussion of conscious appreciation. Conscious appreciation. More on that in just a minute. We've therefore given a model starting from 1, going to 2, 3, and finally to 4. 4 steps of our proposal. To get as much value out of global goods, first of all, then to get as much value out of person-specific goods as they are related to global goods, realizing third that God can take up whatever slack he needs to justify a good by supplying, through his omnipotent hand, goods to a situation, goods that are beyond our ken. But fourth, there may be specific person goods that are not global goods, but which play a crucial role in offsetting and defeating horrendous evils such as Sue's suffering. And so we're developing now, in order to use this model that I've proposed above, we're suggesting a way to answer Roe's fourth question. Why does God allow the specific particular evils that he does in the world? How are we going to do that? Well, let's look at Roe's commitments in the area of the theory of good and evil. Goods of identification or goods of appreciation. Roe, as I've said, is committed to Moore's theory of the appreciation, the conscious appreciation of goods and evils. And so what I'm going to do is make use of Moore's theory. Now, why would we do this? Why would we look to soteriology, the suffering of Christ, and also to Roe's commitment to this philosopher G.E. Moore? Well, for this reason, we're trying to answer Roe, and so if we can make use of those things that he's committed to, as long as they're not completely whacked out and something that we just absolutely cannot accept, as long as that's not the case, why not make use of something we know Roe is committed to? He's convicted that these things are true. And yet we'll make use of soteriology because it's central to our position, and being the case, and that certainly soteriology is never going to leave Christian theology. It is a part of our theory, and it's central. And therefore, we should make use of it as Christian theists. 1 Peter 4 also, more or less, says that if we suffer like Christ did, that we are blessed. And so once again, we look to soteriology. Peter says this, 1 Peter 4:12 and following. Dear friends, do not be surprised at the painful trial you are suffering, as though something strange were happening to you, but rejoice that you participate in the sufferings of Christ, so that you may be overjoyed when his glory is revealed. If you are insulted because of the name of Christ, you are blessed, for the Spirit of glory and of God rests on you. If you suffer, it should not be as a murderer or a thief or any other kind of criminal, or even as a meddler. However, if you suffer as a Christian, do not be ashamed, but praise God that you bear that name. Then, in an interesting statement, Peter says this, for it is time for judgment to begin with the family of God. And if it begins with us, what will the outcome be for those who do not obey the gospel of God? Note here, it's almost as if when we remember the Hebrews 9:27 passage that says that our basic future is once to die, then to face judgment, that humanity's future for those who are living is once to die, then to face judgment. The way Peter says it, it's almost as if, judgment kicks in and begins to take effect on the body of Christ, so as to purify it through suffering. An interesting change of two concepts in Hebrews 9 we see at work in 1 Peter 4. Now here's a potential problem when we look to soteriology. What about counting for the suffering of people who are not Christians? What good is their suffering? We can appreciate suffering as a Christian because if we participate in the sufferings of Christ, then we're blessed, as 1 Peter 4 says. But what about non-Christians? What about when they suffer? First of all, go back to the global goods and remember the soul-making value of mystery. A person is given the ability to question whether there is some value in suffering and the suffering with which they are acquainted in history, for example, by himself going through suffering. The person may have a sympathetic identification with Christ, I claim, even though they don't know Christ in person or by name. That suffering and the memory of that suffering may help them to increase their moral character, drawing near to ones they loved as they didn't before a certain suffering.